In the matter of Leander Williams versus New Jersey State Parole, may we please have appearances of counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. John Flynn, Assistant Deputy Public Defender for Mr. Williams.
Good evening. Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey.
Mr. Shalom, I know we're late. I don't think it's good evening just yet, but we'll see how long this argument takes. Mr. Flynn.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd respectfully like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
Thank you.
May it please the court. This case is simple. All Your Honors need to do is construe the plain language of the relevant statutes in a manner that is consistent with the purpose of the Earn Your Way Out Act, which was to promote inmates participating in rehabilitative services while they are still serving their custodial sentences in exchange for parole at their parole eligibility date under an automatic standard for parole without consideration of the normal discretionary standard for parole. When you view the relevant statutes in that light, it is clear that the parole board's interpretation that they can disregard a limiting principle that restricts them from confining an inmate in a residential facility to only those instances when it's absolutely necessary for the inmate to meet the discretionary standard of parole, that interpretation is unreasonable and inconsistent with the plain text of the statutes, because it would result in a scenario where the parole board was able to put a parolee who got administrative parole release under the Earn Your Way Out Act into such a facility upon a lesser showing than would be required for a more serious offender who is being paroled in the normal course. So to illustrate this point, I'd first like to briefly discuss the two standards of parole that are at issue in this case, and then turn to the text of 123.59D, which is very central to this appeal. So generally speaking, there's in existence since January 2020, two standards for parole. The ordinary or normal parole standard, which is contained in 123.53A, which is a discretionary standard that requires the parole board to approve by a preponderance of the evidence that the inmate either failed to participate or cooperate in his own rehabilitation, or that there is a reasonable probability that the parolee will violate conditions of parole if released. That contrasts distinctly with the Earn Your Way Out Act, 123.55D, where on essentially three objective criteria, incarcerated person will automatically be entitled to parole at their parole eligibility date if they haven't committed serious offenses, enumerated serious offenses, they haven't committed serious disciplinary infractions in prison in their last 2 years of incarceration, and is relevant to this case, the inmate has completed relevant rehabilitative programs available at the correctional facility while they were still serving their custodial sentence. So it's important to consider the context and the meaning and the purpose of the Earn Your Way Out Act before we turn to the specific limitation the parole board has for residential facility conditions. Because what the legislature did with the Earn Your Way Out Act is it's almost like the mirror image of NERA, where with NERA, the legislature took away the parole board's discretion to consider inmates for parole in the normal course when they've committed serious offenses, made a legislative judgment that they're too dangerous to reenter society. With the Earn Your Way Out Act, the legislature did pretty much the opposite. They took away the parole board's discretion in the opposite fashion because certain low-level offenders who have behaved in prison have demonstrated rehabilitation. The legislature deemed that those people were fit to reenter society already. So it's that context that is critical to understanding how 123.59D must operate in this case.
Except the parole board can set conditions, correct?
Right. Even for administrative parole release, they can set conditions generally.
And what in there says they can't, in their discretion, make this facility a condition? Other parolees are there. They can allow release for all different reasons from the inpatient facility, and it could be challenged on a reasonableness standard. What in the statute says they can't do what they did here?
So my argument is focused on the second half of the text of 123.59D. So 123.59D says the board panel may parole an inmate to any residential facility if the inmate would not otherwise be released pursuant to NJSA 34-123.53A. That's the standard for parole in the ordinary course. So my contention is that the plain language, that plain language there, when construed within the purpose of the Ordinary Out Act, that second condition, that if the inmate would not otherwise be released. And
they're still out. They wouldn't be released on parole under the other part of the statute, but they're being released here. They're getting out. They're going to a treatment facility that other parolees go to. How is that in any way restricted by that language?
Because this language, so to take a step back, so the parole board and I agree with what this means with respect to an inmate who's getting out in the regular court. As the parole board said in page 11 of its appellate division brief, this if clause means that they can only put an inmate in a residential facility when it would tip the scales in favor of meeting the statutory standard for parole. That's a limiting principle that the legislature chose to enact when they gave the parole board the discretion to put certain parolees in a residential facility, because in a lot of ways, a residential facility is akin to incarceration. Now, I'm not saying that it's the legal equivalent, but it's substantially similar. You can be charged with escape for leaving, your liberties are highly restricted, and you know, there's an abundance of case law discussed by the amici that, you know, inmates don't have due process rights to being transferred from a halfway house to a prison. So in a lot of ways, it's like the most restrictive type of condition that the parole board can impose on someone. And the legislature in 123.59D limited that ability for the parole board to do that to only those situations when it's absolutely necessary. And that if clause, as a matter of law and logic, is never going to be able to be satisfied for a person who is automatically entitled to administrative parole release under the Earn Your Way Out Act, because there's no discretionary standard to consider. There's no tipping the scale. Those three objective criteria, if they are met, the parole board has to release them. So when you construe the relevant statutes together and based on their plain language and their meaning, that's where I'm getting this limitation for the parole board's ability to confine an offender who is getting out under the Earn Your Way Out Act in a residential facility.
This is confinement. This is not release. And that's why it can't happen under the Act. That's your argument.
I would not even go so far to say it's the legal equivalent of confinement in a correctional facility. My argument's a little bit more narrow than that, that this type of restriction is a special condition that is more restrictive than anything else, and they can't impose that one type of special condition on a parolee who gets out under the Earn Your Way Out Act. There is, for someone in the normal who's paroled in the normal course, it counts as parole to be paroled to a residential facility. They have a reasonable expectation that they'll get parole if they meet the discretionary standard, but the way the statute is constructed, they understand that they can be put in a residential facility. The same just simply is not true for an incarcerated person who is automatically entitled to parole release, administrative parole release under the Earn Your Way Out Act.
Did the board acknowledge that the provision that you're talking about didn't apply, 123.59D, didn't the board acknowledge that that provision only applied to adult inmates who were not eligible for administrative parole release and therefore was completely inapplicable to petitioner's case? And doesn't that actually help you because there is no other reference to this type of RPT anywhere else in the statute?
It does kind of help me because they're really trying to say that they're trying to say the limiting principle, that if clause, isn't applicable. But they can't really have it both ways. If they don't want the if clause to be applicable, then they can't have the first half of the sentence be applicable that grants the parole board authority to put someone in a residential facility. So yes, Justice, I do think it actually does help my argument, because the only place that the parole board is given statutory authority to impose this type of restrictive residential facility condition just simply cannot apply to someone who is getting out under the Earn Your Way Out Act.
The pathway there, and it's a little confusing because you had an overlay of some provisions that pre-existed the Earn Your Way Out Act, and then the Earn Your Way Out Act had some provisions that were brand new, which include, you know, 55C and D, for example, little d. But then some things that were left intact, but then they plugged in some cross-references. So the path I think you were suggesting to us is, if we look at 123.59, and we see D as in David there, the appropriate board panel may parole an inmate to any residential facility. That's the core issue, right? Funded in whole, but would, if the inmate would not otherwise be released pursuant to, and then they go to site 123.53. So if you go to that section, 5.3, it's talking about an adult inmate who is not eligible for administrative parole release under the Earn Your Way Out Act. So if you tie all that together, what they're basically saying is that you can't, or the authorization to parole to a residential facility only applies to certain categories of individuals. And there's a carve out when you go refer to 53 that says this is not a path that the board can use for an inmate who is eligible for administrative parole release. In other words, the Earn Your Way Out Act kind of person. Am I putting it together consistent with what your argument is?
Yes, Judge Sabatino, that's exactly my position. And then 123.55D, as in David, the little d, also has a carve out that says, notwithstanding 153A, the inmate will automatically be entitled to administrative parole relief. So when you look at all the cross-references, that's exactly the path on.
Here's my question. It ties in with what Justice Solomon was asking about. Independent of the language in D, 123.59, that says the board panel may parole to a residential facility, are there other parts of the statutory scheme that give the board the power to impose various conditions, including residential placement? Or is this the exclusive way the board can impose that residential condition?
It's the exclusive way the board can impose that residential facility condition. So subsection D needs to be read in context with subsection B1A that says you have all these automatic conditions and other conditions that the parole board deems reasonable and order to reduce the likelihood of recidivism, but the limiting principle in D has to override that grant of general authority in B1A.
Following up on that, for a defendant who is not eligible for administrative parole, the board needs to make the finding in B1A that the condition of residential treatment is reasonable in order to reduce the likelihood of recurrence of criminal or delinquent behavior. Is that correct?
That's right.
Is there anything else that the board needs to find to impose the RTP?
Yes, for someone who's being paroled in the normal course, they also have to make a finding that without the restrictive residential facility condition, there is a reasonable expectation that the inmate would violate a condition of parole. And that's the discretionary standard for parole under the 1997 Act.
In an effort to read these statutes in harmony, the argument that the state is advancing is that the RTP condition can be imposed without those two findings. Would it make sense to make those findings a requirement for administrative parole? Would that solve any of the problems here?
I think that would be contrary to what the legislature intended with the Earn Your Way Out Act, because a fundamental part of that was to eliminate consideration of that discretionary, subjective standard of parole where you're trying to determine whether there's a reasonable expectation whether the parolee would violate a condition of parole. That was kind of the whole point of the act, was to streamline the parole process, to not have a parole hearing about that standard, not have as much of a need to develop a robust administrative record as to that standard, because the legislature is presumptively determining, not even presumptively, conclusively determining that people who are entitled to administrative parole release deserve to get out. They've earned their way out. So I think doing that type of judicial surgery would be inappropriate and inconsistent with the legislature's intent in enacting the Earn Your Way Out Act.
But 55D does cross-reference 59 and suggests additional conditions could be imposed. Take a case like this. The opening paragraph of the appellate division decision is quite striking. 45 arrests, 20 convictions, 8 prison sentences, et cetera, et cetera. Are there certain cases where an RTP can be imposed for one who is eligible for administrative parole in a way that would meld the statutes?
My position, Chief Justice, would be no. And I think a good way to answer this is the other aspect of the Earn Your Way Out Act, which we haven't talked about yet, is that it required the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, along with the chairman of the state parole board, to develop comprehensive reentry plans for each inmate. So if you look at NJSA 31B-6-10A, it says staff from the DOC and the parole board must engage with each inmate to develop and implement an individualized comprehensive reentry plan for services during the inmate's incarceration. The definitional section of the Anywhere Out Act 123.55C has a similar definition. And as part of that planning, for someone like Mr. Williams, who undoubtedly had a need for drug treatment services, they're going to be able to give those people treatment in a residential facility while they're still serving the custodial part of their sentence and they're still in the DOC custody. Because the DOC also has the discretion to extend the confines of incarceration and allow someone to go to an RTP during their custodial sentence. So here, for example, Mr. William, before he was eligible for parole, had done over 6 months from April to January, April 2020 to January 2021 at a residential drug treatment facility. Actually, 9 months overall. 6 months at Bo Robinson, more than 6 months, and then 3 months at Harbor House. So when there's a need for someone like Mr. Williams to get drug treatment program, they'll be able to get that while they're still serving the custodial sentence. And in fact, the Earn Your Way Out Act requires the DOC and the parole board to work together to develop a plan to make sure that the incarcerated person is getting those services. So in that regard, in the parole board's amicus response brief, they tried to say that the legislative amendments to add in that the commissioner of the chairman of the parole board has to do this reentry planning with the DOC, but that actually supports my reading of the statute as well, because the legislature, if you look at the legislative statements, you know, the statements of the legislature who passed it too, they were concerned with like kind of ending like a revolving door or having people lingering in prison. They wanted to make sure that incarcerated people were getting the services they needed while they were still serving their custodial sentence, so then they would be prepared to successfully reenter into the community at a predictable date when they receive administrative parole release under the Earn Your Way Out Act. So I don't doubt that someone like Mr. Williams would have benefited and probably did benefit from a residential treatment facility condition. My position is just that he was supposed to get it and did get it while he was still serving his custodial sentence. And then once he was released too, the board could still impose a lot of conditions. In fact, in trying to get Mr. Williams the ability to visit his wife, I proposed a number of them. I said he would do outpatient treatment. I said he was willing to be subject to the electronic monitoring program and have an ankle bracelet and a curfew. They could have mandated random drug tests. All of those things, provided that they were reasonable and not arbitrary and capricious, could have been done after he received administrative parole release. The only condition that the parole board was restricted from imposing on him was the most restrictive one, being confined to a residential facility after he was granted administrative parole release.
Couldn't we also reach that result by holding that confinement in an RTP is just not one of the conditions that can be imposed under B1A, because B1A refers to things like not owning or possessing a firearm, obtaining permission from your parole officer for a change in residence, internet access, restitution, no contact with the victim's residence, place of employment, or school, prohibition on owning or possessing an animal for an unlawful purpose. None of these seem similar at all. They, in fact, seem fundamentally different to being confined for an additional 6 months.
I completely agree, Justice, and I think that's just another way in which the plain text of the relevant statutes, considered with the overall intent of these statutes, really supports my reading of the statute and renders the parole board's interpretation wrong.
If RPT instead was included as one of the potential conditions that could be imposed under B1A, then wouldn't that render 59D superfluous? Because if it already could be rendered under 59B1A, why would 59D have to say the appropriate board panel may parole an inmate to any residential facility funded in whole or in part by the state if the inmate would not otherwise be released pursuant to X without any such placement? It seems like if that was meant as a limitation and not as a grant of authority, it would have had to say may only parole an inmate to any residential facility in whole or in part if the inmate would blah, blah, blah. Since it doesn't say may only, it seems like it's stated as a grant of authority. And if it is a grant of authority, then what is B1A? If B1A also allows RPT, how is that not superfluous?
So yeah, that's exactly right. So 59 D would be superfluous if it was already covered by 53B1A. And we also know that 53.9 is fundamentally meant to be a limiting principle. If we look at the legislative history of 12359D that I discussed in my appellate division brief at 25 and 26, as originally proposed, it actually did not have that if clause. And then prior to becoming part of the Parole Act of 1978, the legislature added in that language. So that's even another reason how we know that 123.59G is not like solely a grant of authority, it's actually a limiting principle too. So not only would it be superfluous to 123.53B1A, it would also, the actual text of the statute also supports that it's a limiting principle. And just to also kind of harking back to your last question, I mean, that the parole board really procedurally and improperly kind of submitted this certification attached to their response to the amicus brief to say that, you know, there's all these dramatic differences between an incarcerated person while they're still serving their custodial sentence, their experience in RTP versus a parolee's experience in RTP. So first off, I think it should probably just be disregarded as procedurally improper to try to expand the record in a reply brief to an amicus. But even if you were to consider it, the certification itself really kind of shows that they're substantially similar. Like, this is not like other conditions that can be enacted on B1A. You know, at best, the parolee can maybe leave in some circumstances to go to like a medical appointment or a court hearing. It's not dramatically different. Like, just look what happened to Mr. Williams in this case. He could not visit his wife, who was in hospice, dying of cancer, without an escort. In fact, when we first requested this, he was told after he called his wife that, oh, your wife sounds fine on the phone, and we're not going to allow this to happen unless something gets much worse. And the doctor actually had to call and say that he had 48 hours to leave, and then he needed to be taken with an escort. So, you know, in contrast to what the certification tries to do, I think it's pretty clear that it's a lot closer to being incarcerated. It's substantially similar to having your liberties restricted to being in RTP as a parolee. And that's why we know that when we read the statutes based on their plain language, that 123.59D was meant to be a limiting principle, and it must limit the parole board's discretion to parole an inmate who is going to automatically be released under the Earn Your Way Out Act into such a restrictive facility. Unless your honors have questions, I would just conclude by saying that, you know, it's easy to get lost in the text of the statutes in a case like this, but what this case is fundamentally about, it's about people. It's about people who've not committed serious offenses, who've behaved in prison, who've completed relevant rehabilitative services. And what the parole board did to Mr. Williams in this case, forcing him to be confined, even though he'd already had 9 months of inpatient drug treatment program, even though their own mental health evaluator recommended outpatient treatment and not inpatient treatment. That wasn't reasonable, that wasn't fair, and that was not authorized by the law.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I adopt in full the terrific arguments made by Mr. Flynn, and will just try and make three very quick points. First, I'll try and respond to a question Justice Solomon asked, then to a question you asked, Mr. Chief Justice, and then I'll also respond briefly to the response that the Attorney General provided to the amicus brief filed by the ACDL and the ACLU. Mr. Flynn addressed this, Justice Solomon, but let me just try and take another stab at it. It is clear that the parole board has broad authority to issue conditions of release when they're granting parole in the ordinary course. And there's just one condition where there is a substantive limitation imposed by the legislature before Earn Your Way Out. And that was, except, so you can give curfews, you can tell them they can't have animals for an unlawful purpose, all of those things can always be done, subject to an arbitrary and capricious review. But if you want to send someone to a residential treatment facility, then you need to satisfy this more onerous standard. So the parole board's authority was cabined there. Earn Your Way Out further cabined the parole board's authority to deny release in general. And so it's anomalous to think that in this under this statute, for these low-level offenders who have behaved and who have taken advantage of institutional programming, that they would, in that situation where the parole board had its authority shrunk, we'd say, except as it relates to this one area where we'd already shrunk your authority, then we're going to expand it. That's illogical. Chief Justice, Rabner, you're right. There are some things in Mr. Williams, in the beginning of the appellate division opinion, that suggests that Mr. Williams was someone in desperate need of drug treatment. It's also noteworthy that he received an 8-year sentence for simple possession of drugs. All of that to say, and Mr. Flynn also addressed this, nothing in the argument that you're hearing from anyone on this side suggests that residential treatment facilities are inappropriate. What we're saying and what the Earn Your Way Out Act says is those are the sort of resources that should be made available to incarcerated people while they are incarcerated, before they are parole eligible. And that's the failure to take advantage of that then. It's not to denigrate residential treatment facilities. It's to say you don't get to first have the person serve a punitive 4-year sentence and then start getting them the treatment that they desperately need. I cited a case in my brief called Asquith. It's a Third Circuit case, and it talked about some of the conditions of residential treatment facilities that are so onerous such that there is no due process distinction between them and prison. And so it talked about things like being subject to having to stand for count, being subject to urine monitoring, things of that nature, being subject to escape if you leave. In the reply from the Attorney General, which I agree there's this procedurally improper certification, but it's remarkable for what the certification says. The certification says, listen, the experience in an RCRP is different for someone sent there from the DOC versus parole. They can both leave for jobs, but the people who are sent there from parole can go to the DMV. Now, query whether that's a privilege or a punishment, but there are very few substantive distinctions, and none of them address those onerous conditions that the Third Circuit had reference. Those all apply, and in fact, it seems like Mr. Williams was subjected to far more significant restraints. So when he was able to, as Mr. Flynn said, go see his dying wife, he required an escort. That suggests that this isn't out in the vernacular of the legislature. This is earn your way to a different facility, and that is not what the legislature meant when they cabined the parole board's authority. Unless there are further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Bailey.
May it please the court. I adopt the arguments of my colleagues, and I'll keep this brief. First, I'd like to address the three statutes that we contend are at play here. Section 59B1A lists special conditions which the parole board can impose, including everything from the parolee may not possess a firearm to no contact requirements. Section 59D, on the other hand, expressly limits the parole board's ability to parole an incarcerated person to a residential treatment facility only if they wouldn't otherwise be released without that placement. 59B1A doesn't mention release to residential treatment facility as a special condition the parole board may impose because 59D specifically limits that release to one narrow scenario. The appellate division's reasoning that 59B1A is not an exclusive list and allows the board broad discretion to impose special conditions, including residential treatment facilities, renders Section 59D superfluous. The legislature wouldn't have drafted 59D to limit residential treatment facilities as a special condition if it were allowed under 59B1A. The existence of 59D itself shows that the legislature intended to limit parole to residential treatment facilities to that narrow circumstance. The legislature clearly recognizes that these residential treatment facilities are highly restrictive. The narrow circumstance enumerated in 59D didn't occur here for the reasons discussed by my colleagues. 53A specifically states that it applies only to adult incarcerated persons who aren't otherwise eligible for administrative parole release pursuant to Earn Your Way Out, meaning that the conditions set forth in 59D can't apply to those who qualify for Earn Your Way Out. Earn Your Way Out was enacted to remove discretion from the parole board to get nonviolent people out of prison sooner, not to transfer incarcerated persons from prison to another highly restrictive facility. I'll briefly touch on ACDLNJ's due process concerns. The purpose of ACDL's due process argument is to support a reading of Earn Your Way Out that avoids constitutional issues. While the parole board highlights the various differences between incarceration and residential treatment facility, as you've heard from my colleagues, Mr. Williams had a very highly restrictive experience. The board does have broad discretion to impose special conditions, But the legislature wouldn't have created this possible error and draft a statute which allows parole to such a highly restrictive facility when an incarcerated person qualifies for administrative release under Earn Your Way Out. Section 55C of Earn Your Way Out, the definition section, says that administrative parole release shall not require a parole consideration hearing. That's because the legislature sought to streamline release, and Earn Your Way Out's drafters didn't contemplate release to a residential treatment facility. Put simply, the parole board just lacks the authority to parole someone who qualifies for administrative release under Earn Your Way Out to a residential treatment facility as a special condition of administrative parole release. If there are no questions, thank you all for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Cohen.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. The appellate division's affirmance of the parole board's final agency decision was proper for two specific reasons. First, as the appellate division rightly noted, the parole board's imposition of the special condition was entitled to deference, as there was sufficient credible evidence in the record to support its decision. And secondly, and contrary to Williams' position, the board has the statutory authority to require incarcerated persons to participate in a residential treatment program as a special condition of parole, even for those obtaining parole under the Earn Your Way Out Act. I know that the statutory interpretation dispute is the focus of this petition, but I first briefly wanted to address deference, because ultimately, if the court agrees with our interpretation, the board has authority for what it did, it would still need to find that there was a sufficient basis here on the record for the court to affirm. So the Parole Act specifically permits the board to set special conditions on parole that are deemed reasonable to reduce the likelihood of recurrence of criminal or delinquent behavior, so long as those conditions are tailored to the particular individual. Here, the record was clear that in addition to a pre-release psychological evaluation showing a medium risk for recidivism and poor chances of finishing parole, Williams had an extensive criminal history involving drug-related crimes, multiple parole and probation violations, as well as his own longstanding drug and alcohol abuse issues. Thus, the board rationally concluded that in addition to any programming that Williams did receive while incarcerated, an additional structured program providing a residential or structured programming in the residential treatment facility for 180 days would increase his chances of completing parole successfully. This court has recognized the uniqueness of the parole board. Its members are appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate. They bring expertise in law, sociology, criminal justice, juvenile justice, and related branches of social sciences. The parole board is the one entrusted with the specialized knowledge to administer the regulatory scheme, and they are responsible for making decisions regarding parole, as well as the particular conditions for parole. Williams and Amici asked this court to view the additional support that would be provided in a rehabilitative treatment center as punitive. That is not the case. These programs are specifically designed to benefit parolees and help ensure that those who need extra support, like Williams, are given every opportunity to learn the skills and habits that will help them be successful both during parole and afterwards. The purpose of parole is not just to let incarcerated people out. Rather, as Assemblywoman Egan Jones noted, it's about providing these individuals with the access to needed resources to help them during their next steps in life, both during incarceration and, more importantly for parole, during parole, and to provide every opportunity for them not to recidivate. This is the legislative intent behind the Parole Act and the Earn Your Way Out Act, and assigning someone to a residential treatment facility to assist them in, you know, obtaining the skills necessary not to recidivate is consistent with that intent. With respect to the statutory purpose behind the Earn Your Way Out Act, William insists that the board lacked the statutory authority to send him to a residential treatment facility. But this argument is based on a misunderstanding of the relevant statute. The Earn Your Way Out Act merely modified the process by which the board grants parole for certain incarcerated persons. It did not change the board's authority to impose conditions to ensure that parole is successful. This is clear from the plain text of the act, which specifies that individuals granted parole under the Earn Your Way Out Act remain subject to the provisions and conditions established by the board under the same standards as the other parolees. The Parole Act at 34123.59 does detail, as Your Honors have noted, a list of certain special conditions the board may set. This list, however, is not exhaustive, and the statute specifies that these are among other things the board can impose. As this court unanimously recognized in JK, among other things is a term of enlargement, not of restriction. Subsection D, on which William relies, does not apply to Earn Your Way Out parolees. Rather, it simply affords, or other parolees, actually, rather, it affords the board the additional ability to provide parole to those who would otherwise not be qualified for it. This language is permissive, and as the court also explained in JK, permissive does not mean exclusive.
Can I halt you there just for a second?
Yes.
So you're looking at D in 123.59, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you say that the condition of imposing residential treatment is not aimed at dealing with people under the Earn Your Way Out Act, but yet looking, what do you make of the cross-reference in D in the third line, to 123.53, that speaks to administrative parole release. Am I wrong that the phrase administrative parole release is alluding to someone who is being released pursuant to the Earn Your Way Out Act, or am I misunderstanding that?
123.53 does apply, Your Honor, to those who are earning parole through the Earn Your Way Out Act. But this particular provision is designed... This being 120... I always get confused.
Alphabet
so
soup.
I apologize. There's so many provisions, yeah. I always get a little confused. But it's 123.59D specifies the appropriate board panel may parole an inmate to any residential facility funded in whole or in part if the state would otherwise... that the inmate would otherwise not be released pursuant to sections of parole without such placement. Now here it's designed to afford the board the opportunity to send them to a residential treatment facility if they would not otherwise be earning parole. Obviously under the Earn Your Way Out Act, they are automatically entitled to parole, assuming they meet the criteria under the Earn Your Way Out Act. The question is, can the board impose a condition, a special condition, above and beyond that?
Well, Mr. Williams, though, was claiming eligibility under the Earn Your Way Out Act, right?
Correct.
So why would he be covered by this?
He's not covered by this. This is designed to cover people who would otherwise not be entitled to parole. But that's saying that just because you can provide that you can send other people who wouldn't be entitled to parole to a residential treatment facility, I believe what the public defender's argument is that that's a limitation principle and you can't do it for any other people. And that's not consistent with the plain language of the statute, which... Yes.
I don't think that's, I didn't mean to interrupt you, I'm sorry. I don't think that's what they're saying. I think what they're saying is they had to release him under Earn Your Way Out. He met all the qualifications. They had to release him. So when it says the limitations would not otherwise be released pursuant to that section, which includes the Earn Your Way Act provision, it doesn't apply to this parolee. He would get out. In other words, that state-funded inpatient treatment facility is available unless he would be paroled under Earn Your Way Out. It seems to be what they're saying. And it seems to be what it says in the statute. No?
Except, Your Honor, the appropriate board panel may, and as this court has recognized in JK, may, in subsection C, which was right above it, may is meant to be expansive. The court knows, so stepping back, the legislature knows how to make something specific and on a limiting principle. And if the legislature didn't want the parole board to have in its toolkit the ability to provide programming with respect to, people being sent to a residential treatment facility, they could say it only applies to, right? And that's not what they're saying.
Is there another part of the statute that expressly provides for RTPs?
So there's no other part of the statute that specifically addresses RTPs. However, subsection B1A gives the parole board the authority to impose conditions of parole and special conditions of parole so long as they are authorized and designed to assist.
Sure. So I heard the argument as the specific overrides the general, and the specific language is at 59D, which doesn't apply here. It means RTP is not available here. How do you respond to that?
I mean, the specific overriding the general, the specific being that they...
Specific language in 59D about when RTP is and is not appropriate overrides the general language in 55DB.
So there's nothing in the... So the statute, so subsection D, Your Honor, is really designed for individuals who wouldn't otherwise be entitled to it. But with respect to the specific overriding the general, if you look at the legislative intent and the legislative history here, which I know the public defender is insisting and supports their position, the parole board, you know, likewise says it supports theirs. And if you go to the, as we cited in our brief, the section that's talking about the cost that is going to be to the parole board and the legislative costs. And the parole board identifies that they expect that an additional 1,953 people are going to be, you know, needing treatment under the rehabilitation, the Earn Your Way Out Act. If the legislature thought, no, wait a second, we don't mean that to apply, they could have put in a limiting provision and said, no, that's not applying. That's not what they did here.
Sorry, just to make sure I understand. So you're not arguing that 4-123-.59D is the grant of authority for paroling someone to RTP when that person is entitled to administrative parole, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so instead, you're finding your grant of authority only in 123.59B1A.
Correct.
Okay, but under 123.59B1A, doesn't it talk about conditions like not owning or possessing a firearm, having to tell your parole officer when you change residence, access to the internet, restitution, no contact with the victim's school or residence, prohibition on owning an animal for an unlawful purpose? How are any of these in any way similar to RTP, which effectively keeps a person in a custodial setting for 6 additional months?
So, Your Honor, responding to that, it's after all of that specific stuff where the legislature is identifying special conditions. It goes on to note such special conditions may include, among other things, and the among other things is what this court has previously noted is broad.
Correct.
And is not.
We noted it was broad and could, for example, include a restriction on international travel by parolees, right? That was the specific restriction at issue in JK.
That was, although the specific thing at issue in JK, although this court noted that the parole board has a broad grant of authority under the statute as a whole.
So what is the limiting principle to the parole board's grant of authority? If there was a residential treatment program that was exactly like incarceration, could the parole board reincarcerate someone, or could they reincarcerate someone in a different jail for an additional 6 months as a condition?
So, Your Honor, that would be subject, right, to the general reviews by this court of whether that's arbitrary and capricious, whether it violates constitutional issues.
But there's statutory authority to impose any condition, even though B1A lists very specific conditions, and none of those conditions are in any way similar to either reincarceration or custody for an additional 180 days.
They're not exactly similar, no, but again, it's the among other things, and it's that broad interpretation. It's identifying specific. It's not designed to mean everything that the parole board has the authority to do. And here again, going back to the issue of what these treatment facilities are designed to be is, the amici argue, it's just incarceration under a different title. But the only different, I mean, I guess the similarity, right, is there is a limitation on movement. But limitation on movement in of itself does not mean incarceration, as specifically noted by the statute that upon Williams and them rely, where the court says it's parole. It constitutes as parole. They earn parole credits. They're getting parole. They're not being... They have the liberty interest, Your Honor, in getting out of prison. But getting out of prison and then getting treatment, you don't have a liberty interest in, you know, additional conditions on parole.
I'm sorry if I confused things before earlier when I asked about specific and general. The specific is the language in D. The general is the, among other things, language in B1A. But I assume your answer is the same.
My answer, yes, Your Honor, my answer.
Are there any findings that the parole board must make before imposing an RTP for someone eligible for administrative parole?
That it has to be consistent, right, with what the other special conditions would be, that it has to be likely to reasonably reduce, you know, likelihood of recidivism, of criminality or other delinquency.
You mentioned that an inmate could challenge this designation. Is there, from a practical perspective, enough time for that to take place?
So, well, yes, Your Honor, practically. So with respect to Williams,
Some water, if you want.
So with respect to process, right, it's the opportunity and the notice to be heard, and that was provided here. And the parole board's normal course is 90 days, as set forth, as we identified in our brief, from hearing to when it, you know, a decision needs to be made. That's the general. Obviously, here, it was done on an expedited basis by the parole board, and it's my understanding that in other situations where individuals are complaining about, you know, the special condition of an RTP being imposed, the parole board is expediting its review of those as well.
So that's the parole board's review.
Correct.
Judicial review as well. The argument that was advanced by your colleagues on the other side of the aisle, is there practically time for judicial review in these cases?
So 2 points to that, Your Honor. To the extent that there isn't, and I recognize, right, that the public defender's argument is, and amici's argument, is that they're getting, you know, within 90 to 180 days is the routine normal for people to be in these RTPs, that normally doesn't provide for sufficient time for judicial review of what would be occurring. But the response to that, their argument seems to say that there's a condition here. It doesn't have time for sufficient judicial review, so you shouldn't impose the condition. That can't be the argument. The argument can be, as this court has recognized in EO 124 and Byrne, like, you can expedite things. The parole board has been expediting on their end.
I'm still having trouble wrapping my head around the answer to my first question, so please forgive me. It seems that 12359D says the parole board can send somebody to a residential treatment facility if they would not otherwise be paroled under that statute. And the defendant is arguing, I had to be paroled. It says shall be released. This imposes a condition that is not a condition of release under the Earn Your Way Out statute. And therefore, this is, because it's limited by that, it doesn't apply to this defendant. You can impose all the conditions you want, but this kind of state-funded residential treatment facility is not one of the conditions you can impose, because it's not he would not otherwise be released. He had to be released. He shall be released. I think that's their argument.
He shall be released, Your Honor. The question is, he shall be released from prison. And then the question is, can you impose special conditions? And so, stepping in, and maybe I
I'm saying, and that's what I don't understand. This says they can send them to a residential treatment facility if that's part of what they need, and he wouldn't otherwise be released. And your adversary is saying he had to be otherwise released. It's not like he would not otherwise be released under the Earn Your Way Out Act. He had to be released. He met all the conditions. So this, therefore, does not apply. I think I'm getting that right. I'm just having trouble wrapping my head around.
I think you're getting it right, Your Honor. And I might not have been clear in my answer. So let me try it a different way. So this subsection D says that the appropriate board panel may apply to any residential if the inmate would not otherwise be released pursuant to. It's designed to allow for parole for individuals that are not these, so it doesn't apply to them. So yes, it's a totally, I think as we noted in our papers, it's a totally different subset of people. This is just allowing you the authority to provide parole to individuals who wouldn't otherwise be subject to parole. It's an addition, right? It's the permissive of allowing the board the authority to place people there. However, that's for parole. The question then becomes, what about special conditions?
So your argument is it only applies if they would not be released. If they would not be released, then this option. All right.
Right. So, Your Honor. So, that this applies to individuals who wouldn't otherwise be, and the parole board has the option of sending those individuals to parole
with inpatient treatment. But their argument, I think, is it's not a question of would he otherwise be. He had to be otherwise released. Right. Under the Earn Your Way Out Act, if he met all that checklist, he gets out. They can impose all the conditions they want, but this limitation on residential treatment, that can't be imposed because he would otherwise be released.
But if that was the case, if that's truly what, accepting that that's what the legislative intent happened to be, it would seem to be inconsistent with the fact that when while the Earn Your Way Out Act was going through the process, the legislative services, we submitted the provisions about how much it would cost potentially for parole, and parole noted there would be additional people under the Earn Your Way Out Act of like 1900 and I think 21, 23 that would be going to these residential treatment facilities, and the legislature didn't say, oh no, we didn't mean that for that.
Conditions have to be reasonable for the Earn Your Way Out population?
The conditions of parole?
Parole have to be reasonable.
They have to be reasonable for any parolee, Your Honor.
How many people are you saying have been entitled to administrative release and have been, instead of being released with, you know, some of the named conditions in B1A, instead been released to RPT?
So, Your Honor, it's my understanding there's about, since the inception of the Earn Your Way Out Act, there's around 1,500 individuals that were entitled to parole under the Earn Your Way Out Act.
So just to make sure, so 1,500 people that were entitled to administrative parole under Earn Your Way Out were sent to RPT?
No, Your Honor. I have the bit. 1,158 were released. And of those,
pursuant
to the administrative parole release, yes.
Yep.
1,158 offenders were released pursuant to the administrative parole release.
Yep.
Of those, 532 had the conditions of RTPs.
So 532 out of 1,158 were sent to RPT.
Right. Now, also, I think,
even though you agreed that RPT is not at all similar to any of the other conditions listed in B1A, either general or special.
It's not. Yes, I agree, Your Honor. It's not. But again, I would note that it's not designed, as this court has noted on many occasions, designed to list everything. They just listed some things. And the among other things is expansive, not designed to be limiting. I would like to address.
I'm sorry, ask a question.
Yes.
The other 600 or so who were not released into RTP, can you tell us whether they had any conditions applied to them?
I can't, as we speak here. I mean, other special conditions apply to them. I can't affirmatively say one way or another. If Your Honor wants that information, we can provide it. I can seek it out.
What I'm trying to get a sense of is this a standard condition in practice that's being applied? It's 45% or so of the pool, which is a sizable number.
It is a sizable number, Your Honor. The question is whether that's allowed under, right? Under the statute and then under normal parole conditions. And so whether other special conditions have been applied, such as, you know, not drinking alcohol or doing other things, I have to believe that of those other parolees that weren't sent here, that, you know, they had some special conditions of their own, likely. I just can't tell you what those happen to be at the moment. But with respect to the number, there's a couple of things to keep in mind that I think apply to that here. First of all, a significant number of the individuals that would be subject to release under the Earn Your Way Out Act or, you know, administrative parole release are in fact low-level drug offenders. Not completely, but that is a sizable portion of them. And to the extent that their history and background shows, like Mr. Williams here, that it's warranted that they happen to go to additional treatment facilities, that is one potential reason for the being sent there. Also, with respect to the Earn Your Way Out Act, it was enacted during COVID, right? And so a lot of the incarcerated individuals were in county jail and not getting the benefit of the treatment programs that they would in the Department of Corrections if a plan had been in place there. And by the time they get to the Department of Corrections and, in fact, need to get the benefits of the programs, they are already up for their administrative parole release, their parole hearing day, and so they're going to be let out without the benefit of those programs. And the Earn Your Way Out Act specifies, I apologize because there's so many statutes, but the one that specifically identifies, like 123-53, says that the conditions are that you have had the benefit of the programs or through no fault of your own couldn't engage, whether that is because of COVID limitations, whether that's because the Department of Corrections, just there was like a limitation on who could get in or the crime that you're in for is up too short and you just don't have the time. All of those can be factors. But what the public defender seems to be arguing is that if in fact you've had these programs, whether you got, you know, the benefit of them or not, you get out. And if you had these trainings while you were in jail, that's sufficient. But we know that that's not necessarily the case. For example, Mr. Williams had longstanding drug and alcohol abuse. One of the programs he had while he was incarcerated was attending Alcohol Anonymous, correct? The Alcohol Anonymous is a continuation of his special condition. I don't think that amici or the public defender are we saying you can't impose that special condition, right? It's just this special condition of the RTRP. And that gets to the question of whether it's designed to be punitive or designed to be, you know, to assist the individuals and the public, you know, the parole board's position is that this is a tool that they use to provide support and training to assist individuals who would not otherwise, you know, get the benefit of that, and hopefully help them be a successful on parole. And the out is out is it can't possibly be.
So we know the Earn Your Way Out Act is designed to streamline the process for release. Leads me to one more question about numbers. Do you know the percentage or the number of individuals who are not eligible for administrative parole who are given a special condition of RTP?
So I don't, I mean, that was a question I've asked, and I'll get in the information, and if your honors want it, I will provide that supplemental. I know that they do, and they are. It's not just under the Earn Your Way Out Act. There are, you know, people, like, through the traditional path through the parole that are also being sent to the RTRPs, but the specific number I don't have in front of me.
Not giving us the specific number, is it on a par with that percentage here that we have?
I don't have that, Your Honor, but I will. So I don't know.
There are also inmates who are serving their sentences who are going to these programs as well.
Correct, Your Honor.
They're segregated from the parolees, but they're there.
Yes.
Do you know, have any idea of how many parolees are challenging who are released under the, or eligible under the Earn Your Way Out Act, who were the 530 or so who were sent to residential programs have been litigating or challenging their confinement?
So I'm not aware of any others other than Mr. Williams who have specifically litigated it. I know during the parole process that others have challenged that.
Nothing in the appellate.
But nothing going, like, in the courts are going to.
And just hypothetically, again, not forecasting either way who's legally correct. But if it turns out that the appellant is legally correct here, do you have any immediate thoughts about a remedy or a way to deal with the folks that are being held perhaps contrary to the statute? No,
Your Honor.
I mean, because
so here's another issue to consider on the back end. And again, I keep hearkening on JK, but I think because this court rightly recognized that the parole board has broad authority under this, and that it's parole board's position that, you know, obviously 59D isn't the limiting factor. But the parole board, in connection with sending, you know, individuals to treatment facilities to assist them with treatment, also utilizes it on the back end, meaning that if somebody is on parole and there is an issue with it, whether they're not showing up for their hearings or not, they're not complying in some other manner with the terms of parole, normally the course would be to send them, you know, back to prison. That's the option the board has. The board utilizes this as a tool, and I don't think that the public defender in them would be opposed to having the treatment be, no, we're not going to send you back to incarceration. What we're going to try to do is to correct things through these rehabilitative treatment. But if you accept their proposition that the only way that the legislature truly intended for anyone getting out, especially like the Earn Your Way Out Act, only people who couldn't get out otherwise for them would be there, would go to the rehabilitative treatment, then you're depriving the board of a tool that it really uses to help.
Are you saying that if someone violates parole, then they can be sent back to prison or they can be sent back to RPT? But if we find that there's no authority to send someone entitled to Earn Your Way Out administrative parole to RPT as administrative parole, then that person would have to go back to jail and would not be able to go to RPT violate parole.
Correct. I'm saying, Your Honor, that if, yes.
Why would that be true? So, because B1A is not talking at all about what can happen if you violate parole. It is just talking about conditions that can be special conditions or regular conditions that can be imposed on parole, not about parole violation. I assume what can happen in parole violation is subject to a different statute, correct?
It's subject to the same statute, but it's further subsection down in the statute. But I'm saying that the only place where RTP happens to be mentioned specifically, and that is what the court's relying on and saying that in looking at this statute and the, you know, the RTP is just specifically for here, it's a limiting principle, then
no, but again, what if what we're principles. Saying is 59D doesn't grant authority for RPT, but 59B1A does grant authority for many types of conditions, just not RPT, because RPT is very dislike all of the conditions listed in B1A, then that would have no implication on what the board could or could not do if someone violates parole, correct?
What this court does, then correct, Your Honor, and that would be fine. But I guess the question is, again, the B1A, and we keep talking a lot about how this one condition is to use, because I was watching Sesame Street the other day, but it's not like the others, right? It's completely different. But just because it's not like the others doesn't mean it is something the board can't do for a special condition. D is dealing with the parole of individuals who wouldn't otherwise really. So,
can you tell us the section of the statute you were thinking of with respect to parole revocation? And if you can't, off the top of your head.
I have actually one quick second. Please. Modifications. I can't off the top of my head, and I did have it, and I apologize, but there is a specific section dealing with parole revocations.
She's on Mr. Flynn right now. Don't worry.
Can I ask you one final question about mootness? You had argued below that this was moot because defendant completed the RPT. Do I understand correctly that you agree that the imposition of an RPT condition is capable of repetition, obviously, since it's been done 532 times, yet because of the length of the treatment program would otherwise be evading judicial review? For mootness purposes only. Capable of repetition, yet evading review.
So, yes, that is why this court allowed us to proceed. So,
and you're not aware of any cases in the pipeline?
No.
Other questions, anyone?
No.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honors, I think that covers.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. Mm-hmm. Mr. Flynn, rebuttal? And I was kidding. If you know the statutory site, please, we welcome it. And if not,
I do know the statutory site, Chief. It's 123.60A. And basically, it says, if you violate parole, you can be required to conform to one or more additional conditions of parole or forfeit commutation credits is A. And then B says, any parolee who has seriously or persistently violated the conditions of his parole may have his parole revoked and may be returned to custody. So my position would be that under B, so if it's a serious and persistent violation that was committed by a parolee who's on administrative parole release, that the parole board would in that instance have the discretion either to return them to prison or at that point to return them to a residential treatment facility, because at that point they actually have the authority to recommit them to their custodial sentence. So it's just a completely different scenario than when they were initially automatically entitled to release under the In Your Way Out Act. I would also add, too, that the parole board actually has a regulation on violations of parole that says they should use the least restrictive option as a penalty for the violation, and it lists return to a residential treatment facility. So I don't think the ruling I'm asking for here at all would inhibit the board's ability to, for a violation, to put someone back in a residential treatment facility. It's just a completely different scenario. I guess the other thing I would touch on is briefly like why this is the only case that's in the pipeline. And it's a consequence of the fact that most people don't have representation during parole proceedings. Most indigent people aren't going to be able to hire an attorney when they're already automatically entitled to parole to challenge a special condition like this and then challenge it fast enough to actually obtain any meaningful relief. So the board did expedite the review at the agency level, but then in the appellate division, they opposed my motion to accelerate the appeal. They filed a motion to dismiss the appeal as moot before the appellate division decided it. So
I take it your office doesn't get involved in these as a matter of course. This is a special case?
This is a special case because I was also representing Mr. Williams on a direct criminal appeal. I was representing him for emergency medical home confinement under Executive Order 124, and I would have represented him under the Attorney General's directive eliminating the mandatory minimum for drug offenses. So that was, the directive was enacted in April 2021, and then due to Judge Steele not letting it be enacted right away, he had been paroled by the time he would have. But he would have been relieved from his pretty harsh drug mandatory minimum had things played out differently too. So just because I was already representing him on so many other things is why I'm here today. Unless Your Honors have any further questions, I just ask that you reverse.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Take the matter under advisement.